Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Friday, January 7, 2022. Supreme Court hearing challenges to the Biden administration's vaccine mandates. One case covering large businesses and the second one, healthcare workers at facilities that get federal funding. Mandates in all affecting about 80 million Americans. Some Supreme Court watchers parsing the justices' questions in the oral arguments say the mandate on businesses may be struck down, but the other one for healthcare workers may survive. Jobs report for December from the Labor Department out, 199,000 jobs created, not as many as expected, but the unemployment rate falls sharply from 4.2% to 3.9%. President Joe Biden calling it a historic day for our economic recovery. Secretary of State Antony Blinken previewing next week's talks with Russia over its military buildup on the border with Ukraine. Secretary Blinken also discussing the repression of anti-government protests in Russian ally Kazakhstan. And here in the U.S., in Georgia, sentencing for the three white men convicted of killing a black man, Ahmaud Arbery, who was jogging through their neighborhood. Life in prison for each defendant was a given. Only question today for the judge, whether any of them would get the possibility of parole. And we start with the Supreme Court. New York Times Supreme Court correspondent Adam Liptak writes, members of the Supreme Court's conservative majority seem skeptical on Friday that the Biden administration has the legal power to mandate that the nation's large employers require workers to be vaccinated against the coronavirus or to undergo frequent testing. A federal workplace safety law, they indicated during a two-hour argument, did not provide legal authority for the sweeping emergency measure. The court seemed more likely to sustain a separate requirement that healthcare workers at facilities that receive federal money be vaccinated. That regulation, the subject of a second argument, was in keeping with the other kinds of federal oversight that was supported by virtually the entire medical establishment, some justices noted. That was reporting from the New York Times. Here is a portion of the oral argument in that first case. Again, it concerns the regulation from OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, that workers at companies with 100 or more employees be vaccinated against COVID-19 or tested regularly. Chief Justice John Roberts here questioning U.S. Solicitor General Elizabeth Prelogar.
I understand the idea that agencies are more expert than Congress. I understand the idea that they can move more quickly than Congress. But this is something that the federal government has never done before, right? Mandated vaccine coverage.
It's true that there has been no standard that looks exactly like this one. The federal government has encouraged vaccination, as this standard does, in other provisions like the bloodborne pathogen standard. And masking and medical testing of employees are common features of OSHA standards.
Well, is it that an important consideration that we should take into effect, for example, along with the fact that the police power to take such action is more commonly exercised by the states? And we've had many cases coming out of the states and municipalities that evidence that. And also that it's 50 years ago, Congress passed a general provision, but I think it's certainly hard to argue, and you're doing a good job of it, that gives free rein to the agencies to take, I guess this is invoking the major cases doctrine, that it gives free rein to the agencies to enact such broad regulation that was certainly unfamiliar to Congress in 1970.
Well, there are a lot of elements to that question. I'd like to try to take them in turn. I think that Congress did specifically contemplate that there would be emergency situations that pose grave dangers to workers throughout America, and it specifically empowered OSHA to take action in response to that. I understand the suggestion here that the standard is unprecedented, but I don't think it withstands scrutiny. If you look at the various claims that the applicants are making, they first object to the scope of the standard, the number of employers who are covered, but OSHA commonly issues nationwide standards that govern all employers throughout the nation with respect to risks that exist throughout the nation, and that describes COVID-19. There is substantial evidence here to justify the scope of the standard.
Go ahead.
And just to close the loop with one final response, which is to focus on the particular mitigation measures there, too, we think that there is no indication that Congress couldn't have anticipated or intended OSHA to use these types of measures to combat a deadly virus at work. Immunization is specifically referenced in Section 669A5. It is the single most effective way to target the spread of a deadly virus. And to think that Congress would have meant to preclude OSHA from encouraging vaccination, I think, is inconsistent both with the text of the statute and with the broader history of immunization requirements in this country, which have commonly been imposed.
The U.S. Solicitor General Elizabeth Prelogar, questioned by the Chief Justice John Roberts, oral argument today in the consolidated Supreme Court case, NFIB versus U.S. Department of Labor and Ohio versus U.S. Department of Labor. More from the case, attorney for NFIB, which is the National Federation of Independent Business, Scott Keller, asked by Justice Elena Kagan why current federal emergency authority is not sufficient to justify the COVID vaccination or testing requirement for those large employers.
Why isn't this necessary to abate a grave risk? This is a pandemic in which nearly a million people have died. It is by far the greatest public health danger that this country has faced in the last century. More and more people are dying every day. More and more people are getting sick every day. I don't mean to be dramatic here. I'm just sort of stating facts. And this is the policy that is most geared to stopping all this. There's nothing else that will perform that function better than incentivizing people strongly to vaccinate themselves. So, you know, whatever necessary means, whatever grave means, why isn't this necessary and grave?
Because, Justice Kagan, the standard for what would be necessary for this extraordinary use of emergency power is not what is the best way of accomplishing.
It's an extraordinary use of emergency power occurring in an extraordinary circumstance, a circumstance that this country has never faced before.
What OSHA needed to do here, though, and we do not contest that COVID is a grave danger, but when a power for it to be necessary, for instance, the Third Circuit said in wielding what is supposed to be a delicately exercised extraordinary power, the agency has to consider and explain alternatives. The agency here complained that its non-mandatory guidance wasn't being followed. And then instead of saying that maybe some of those guidances could have been made mandatory, it jumped immediately to a vaccine or testing mandate. Moreover, OSHA typically...
Mr. Carter, I guess I just don't see this as a situation, you know, a typical arbitrary, capricious situation where we say, oh, you didn't consider an alternative carefully enough. We all know what the best policy is. I mean, by this point, 2 years later, we know that the best way to prevent spread is for people to get vaccinated, and to prevent dangerous illness and death is for people to get vaccinated. That is by far the best. The second best is to wear masks. So this is a policy that basically says we are still confronting thousands of people dying every time we look around. And so we're going to put into place the policy that we know works best, which is to strongly incentivize vaccination and to insist that unvaccinated people will wear masks and test. I mean, that's just like, why isn't that necessary? What else should be done? It's obviously the policy that's geared to preventing most sickness and death. And the agency has done everything but stand on its head to show quite clearly that no other policy will prevent sickness and death to anywhere like the degree this one will.
Justice Kagan, first of all, states could have policies like this. Private businesses could have policies like this. And even OSHA in its June healthcare COVID ETS, and that was only for healthcare workers, did not mandate vaccines. Instead, what it did there, similarly to how OSHA proceeds in many contexts, is it says, employers, give us a plan, and then if there are heightened needs in particular workplaces, then additional measures can be put into place. But this is covering economy-wide, all industries.
That's Scott Keller, a lawyer for NFIB, being questioned by Justice Elena Kagan. Again, this was the first Supreme Court case today about vaccine mandates. A second case challenged the Health and Human Services Department vaccination mandate for healthcare workers at places that get federal funding. Name of that was the consolidated cases Biden v. Missouri and Becerra v. Louisiana. C-SPAN carried both cases live, and you can find the audio of the oral argument at cspan.org. High Court only allowing audio at this point in the cases. No cameras. Fox News writes there's no indication from the bench how quickly orders from the court will be issued or when or whether full or written opinions explaining the court's reasoning will be issued. But given the fact that some of these mandates go into effect beginning next week or in the coming weeks, the justice could issue some kind of order as soon as today or this weekend. Now to the jobs report from Associated Press. U.S. employers added a modest 199,000 jobs last month, while the unemployment rate fell sharply at a time when businesses are struggling to fill jobs, with many Americans remaining reluctant to return to the workforce. At the same time, Friday's jobs report from the Labor Department showed the nation's unemployment rate fell from 4.2% to a healthy 3.9%, evidence that many more people found jobs last month. President Biden touting that unemployment rate drop.
I think it's a historic day for our economic recovery. Today's national unemployment rate fell below 4% to 3.9%, the sharpest one-year drop in unemployment in United States history. The first time the unemployment rate has been under 4% in the first year of a presidential term in 50 years. 3.9% unemployment rate. Years faster than experts said we'd be able to do it. And we have added 6.4 million new jobs since January of last year, in 1 year. That's the most jobs in any calendar year by any president in history. How did that happen? Well, the American Rescue Plan got the economy off its back and moving again, back on its feet, getting over 200 million Americans fully vaccinated, got people out of their homes and back to work, even in the face of wave after wave of COVID. We got schools open. We got booster shots. We brought down the poverty rate. It went from 20 million people on unemployment rolls a year ago to under 2 million people on the unemployment rolls today. America's back to work, and there are more historical accomplishments. The increase in Americans joining the labor force was the fastest this year of any year since 1996. And among prime age workers, ages 25 to 54, their increase in labor force participation was the biggest in 43 years. Record job creation, record unemployment declines, record increases in the people in the labor force. I would argue the Biden economic plan is working and is getting America back to work, back on its feet. But the record doesn't stop there. Today's report also tells us that record wage gains, especially for workers in some of America's toughest jobs, women and men who work in the frontline jobs in restaurants, hotels, travel, tourism, desk clerks, line cooks, wait staff, bellmen, they all saw their wages at a historic high, the highest in history. Their pay went up almost 16% this year, far ahead of inflation, which is still a concern. Overall, wage gains for all workers who were not supervisors went up more in 2021 than any year in four decades. There's been a lot of press coverage about people quitting their jobs. Well, today's report tells you why. Americans are moving up to better jobs with better pay, with better benefits. That's why they're quitting their jobs. This isn't about workers walking away and refusing to work. It's about workers able to take a step up to provide for themselves and their families.
President Biden speaking from the White House. He also said he's confident the Federal Reserve will be able to act to both control inflation and ensure that the job growth continues. Businesses will continue hiring new workers. Some Republican reaction to the December jobs report from the Labor Department, focusing on the total jobs created, 199,000. House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy of California tweeting, "It might be a new year, but we are still lowering our expectations when it comes to Biden's economy." And the ranking Republican on the Ways and Means Committee, Kevin Brady of Texas, with this statement, "Another disappointing jobs report proves President Biden bungled the economy in 2021. The Biden jobs deficit, the difference between the jobs created and those he promised to create as part of his so-called stimulus from March, has metastasized to 1.1 million. In fact, studies show the jobs recovery was held back by Democrats' economic policies. One thing is certain, his $5 trillion tax hikes and spending spree would make the economy worse by raising prices, killing jobs, and slowing economic growth." That full statement from Congressman Kevin Brady. Wall Street today, the Dow down 4, NASDAQ dropping 144, S&P down 19. Biden administration announcing it's distributing an additional $4.5 billion to help low-income Americans cover heating costs this winter. It's the second winter under the coronavirus pandemic. The money will come from last year's $1.9 trillion American Rescue Plan coronavirus relief package. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reported this week that daily COVID infections in the U.S. are near 500,000. Hospitalizations and deaths are also up, all due to the highly transmissible Omicron variant. CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky was asked this morning on NBC News Today's show when things might start to get better.
Now, you reported this earlier this week, the 7-day average number of cases up 98%, hospitalizations up 63%, deaths are up too, not as much. Do you expect those numbers to go even further up? When is this new wave going to taper off?
We are still seeing those numbers rising. And as you note, the number of cases are rising faster than the number of hospitalizations and deaths, although we're now starting to see the number of hospitalizations rise as well. The way it has peaked in other countries, in South Africa, it has come down rapidly as well. But I don't believe we've seen the peak yet here in the United States. I will say that our hospitals right now are full of people who are unvaccinated, and that you are 17 times more likely to be in the hospital and 20 times more likely to die if you're unvaccinated compared to if you're boosted. So there's a lot we can do right now in this moment, getting vaccinated, getting boosted. We have 99% of our counties in high transmission. Wear your mask in public indoor settings.
The CDC Director, Dr. Rochelle Walensky, on NBC's Today Show Friday morning. Food and Drug Administration today shortening the time that recipients of the Moderna COVID vaccine need to wait to get a booster shot. It's down to 5 months from 6 months. That puts it in line with the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine booster recommendation. Back to President Biden. At the end of his remarks on the December jobs report, he took one question from reporters. It was about COVID and whether, basically, we need to learn to live with it.
Mr. President, should Americans prepare that COVID is here to stay?
No, I don't think COVID is here to stay. That having COVID in the environment here and in the world is probably here to stay. But COVID, as we're dealing with it now, is not here to stay. The new normal doesn't have to be. We have so many more tools we're developing and continuing to develop that can contain COVID and other strains of COVID. So I don't believe this is that. If you take a look, we're very different today than we were a year ago, even though we still have problems. But 90% of the schools are open now. Was 98, is down to 90, but is open now because we spent the time and the money in the Recovery Act to provide for the ability of schools to remain open. And, you know, what we're doing now is we talked about, how we're dealing with testing. Well, you know, we have been doing now, we've had 300 million tests per month so far. And, that's 11 million tests a day. In addition to that, we're in the process of ordering 500,000 new tests. And so we're going to be able to control this. The new normal is not going to be what it is now. It's going to be better. Thank you very much.
President Biden at the White House. That phrase, new normal, the question and the answer, may have been inspired by a series of journal articles published this week by six former health advisors to President Biden's transition team, calling for a new pandemic strategy to embrace living with what they called a new normal. After the president's remarks at the White House, he headed off to Colorado. He's going to meet with victims from the wildfires there. And then on Saturday, he'll be in Nevada for the funeral of the late U.S. Senator Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid. Also today, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi inviting the president to give the State of the Union address before a joint session of Congress on Tuesday, March 1st. The White House says the president has accepted. And in Republican Party news, Politico, citing an unnamed source, says the Republican National Committee has narrowed the choice of where it plans to hold its 2024 National Convention to four cities: Milwaukee, Wisconsin, Nashville, Tennessee, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and Salt Lake City, Utah. Washington Today continues in a minute. Welcome back to Washington Today, which is available as a podcast on the free C-SPAN Now mobile app and wherever you get your podcasts. Ahead of next week's scheduled talks between Russia and Western nations, Reuters reporting that NATO foreign ministers said on Friday they remained united against any possible Russian military action in Ukraine and signaled that many security demands made by the Kremlin were unacceptable. At the State Department in Washington, D.C., Secretary of State Antony Blinken with this statement.
This morning, NATO's North Atlantic Council met to discuss our coordinated response to Russia's military buildup along the Ukraine border and its increasingly sharp threats and inflammatory rhetoric. I want to thank NATO Secretary General Stoltenberg for bringing us together. As he said in his own press conference a short while ago, Russia's aggressive actions are a threat to peace and security in Europe. We're prepared to respond forcefully to further Russian aggression. But a diplomatic solution is still possible and preferable if Russia chooses it. That's what we, together with our allies and partners, we'll continue to pursue intently next week at the Strategic Stability Dialogue between the United States and Russia, and at the meetings of the NATO-Russia Council and the OSCE, the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe.
The Secretary of State, Antony Blinken. This from CNN. Kazakhstan President Kasym Jomart Tokayev has ordered security forces to kill without warning to crush the violent protests that had paralyzed the former Soviet republic and reportedly left dozens dead. In a defiant public address Friday, he claimed the unrest, which began earlier this week as protests against rising fuel prices, had been masterminded by well-trained terrorist bandits from both inside and outside the country. CNN posted a compilation of a couple of clips from the president's speech.
I gave the order to law enforcement agencies and the army to open fire, to kill without warning. Abroad, there are appeals to the parties to negotiate for a peaceful solution of problems. What nonsense! What kind of negotiations can there be with criminals, with murderers? They need to be destroyed, and this will be done shortly.
That was from CNN, President of Kazakhstan, through an interpreter. Back to the Secretary of State Antony Blinken's news conference, he's asked about the protests and also Russia sending in paratroopers to Kazakhstan to help the government crush them.
Your assessment of events in Kazakhstan and how that potentially weighs on these meetings with Russian officials next week. And more specifically, U.S. officials have raised kind of questions about the CSTO troops deployment there. What specifically is the concern about those troops going in? Is there an implication that the Kazakhstan government hasn't actually invited them in, or how do you see that?
Thanks. So first, we are very concerned about the ongoing state of emergency that exists in Kazakhstan. We've urged authorities to respond appropriately, proportionately, and in a way that upholds the rights of protesters. I spoke with the foreign minister just yesterday. I reiterated our full support for Kazakhstan's constitutional institutions, as well as the absolute importance of respecting human rights, media freedom, including the restoration of internet service, and to dealing with peaceful protests in a way that protects the protesters, upholds their rights, and is consistent with the rule of law. So there has to be a rights-respecting resolution to this crisis. And again, that includes protecting the rights of any peaceful protester. At the same time, we've made clear that we condemn violence committed by anyone, including violence directed at the institutions of the state and government. We very much value the relationship that we have with Kazakhstan. We're watching the situation with real concern. And we are encouraging everyone to find a peaceful resolution and constructive resolution to the situation. When it comes to the CSTO, we have questions about the nature of the request, why it came about. We're seeking to learn more about it. It would seem to me that the Kazakh authorities and government certainly have the capacity to deal appropriately with protests, to do so in a way that respects the rights of protesters while maintaining law and order. So it's not clear why they feel the need for any outside assistance. So we're trying to learn more about it. We certainly call on those peacekeeping forces and law enforcement to adhere to international human rights standards to support a peaceful resolution. And again, we hope the government itself can quickly address the problems, which are fundamentally economic and political in nature. That's what these protests are all about.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken taking reporters' questions at the State Department in Washington. CSTO is the Collective Security Treaty Organization, a military alliance of former Soviet states. From NPR's Goats and Soda blog, as 2022 begins, most people in Afghanistan don't have enough food to eat. Millions are facing hunger and starvation amid a multi-year drought and an economic crash following the Taliban takeover in August. The onset of winter has only made things worse. Today, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi, discussing the situation in Afghanistan under the Taliban. He spoke with Washington Post national security reporter Missy Ryan.
I know that one of the biggest questions that the international community would like an answer to is whether this new Taliban government, the Taliban 2.0, is the same Taliban that ruled Afghanistan very harshly during the 1990s. It may be too soon to answer that question, but what I would like to ask you is, what does the Taliban's ideology and its outlook, as we can observe it to date, on certain issues, including, as you mentioned before, the role of women and religious minorities, mean for the work that UNHCR is doing with displaced Afghans? How does that affect the vital assistance that you all are providing?
This is such an important question that you're asking, and I think it has many aspects. I'll try to be quick in responding. First of all, is this the same type of Taliban government that we saw in the 90s? You know, I've been involved in Afghanistan for decades, so I have some personal comparisons that I can make. I don't know. It's difficult to say. Certainly what has changed, and it has been said many times already, is Afghanistan itself. The Afghanistan that the Taliban took over in 1996, 1997 was profoundly different from the Afghanistan that they have taken over recently. And they have to live with that. They have to cope with that. They have to deal with that situation. And that, I think, is positive in the sense that many investments were made. Many people are saying all those investments are wasted. No, I think all the investments made in 20 years between 2001 and 2021 have changed the country and have made it impossible for anybody to rule it in the way that was tried 25 years ago. So there's a difference there. And what does it mean for us? It means that, of course, we're still dealing with complex aspects of that ideology and that mode of governance. But remember, and that was so obvious to me even in the few days I spent there, and it's certainly obvious to me, obvious to colleagues of mine, that day in, day out are dealing with the Taliban. They're not a homogeneous group. They're very diverse, this different constituencies. They have also to cater to certain constituencies. But I think that there is certainly a vast substantive group among the Taliban with whom we can talk also about the difficult issues that we have mentioned, especially the rights of women, the right of women and the right of minorities, which are still very open discussion. So the dilemma here, or the difficulty here, the challenge here, is to balance the need to deliver quickly humanitarian assistance to millions of Afghans in desperate need, and at the same time, to keep open the discussion on the difficult issues, but without, you know, blocking humanitarian assistance. That would be a great mistake. But it is a difficult balancing act, as you can certainly appreciate.
UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi, interviewed by Missy Ryan, Washington Post national security reporter. A story today from AFP out of France. The Taliban's religious police have put up posters around the capital, Kabul, ordering Afghan women to cover up, an official said on Friday, the latest in a string of creeping restrictions. The poster, which includes an image of the face-covering burqa, was slapped on cafes and shops this week by the Ministry for the Promotion of Virtue and Prevention of Vice. This is Washington Today. A story at Axios. A judge on Friday sentenced Travis and Gregory McMichael, two men convicted in the murder of Ahmaud Arbery, to life without parole. A third white man, William Roddy Bryan, also convicted in Arbery's slaying, was sentenced to life with the possibility of parole. Arbery, a 25-year-old black man, was chased and shot dead while running in February 2020. Prosecutors only pursued the case after a video of the killing went viral in May 2020, sparking national anger. That reporting from Axios. Before the sentencing in Brunswick, Georgia, family members and others speaking to the court. Here is Ahmaud Arbery's mother, Wanda Cooper.
Your Honor, these men have chose to lie and attack my son and his surviving family. They each have no remorse and do not deserve any leniency. This wasn't a case of mistaken identity or mistaken fact. They chose to target my son because they didn't want him in their community. They chose to treat him differently than other people who frequently visited their community. And when they couldn't sufficiently scare him or intimidate him, they killed him. My family is going to miss Ahmaud. We're going to miss his jokes, his impersonations, his warm smile. These men deserve the maximum sentence for their crimes. Ahmaud never said a word to them. He never threatened them. He just wanted to be left alone. They were fully committed to their crimes. Let them be fully committed for the consequences. Your Honor, I'm standing here before you as the mother of Ahmaud Arbery, asking you to please give all three defendants who are responsible for the death of my son the maximum punishment in this court, which I do believe is life behind bars without the possible chance for parole.
Wanda Cooper Jones in the courtroom in Brunswick, Georgia. After all of the victim impact statements and also the arguments by the lawyers for both sides, the defendants and the state, Judge Timothy Walmsley spoke before sentencing.
We're here today to sentence the defendants. In discharging the duty, this court is required to consider all mitigating and aggravating circumstances. The court has considered those circumstances, including but not limited to all aspects of the crimes charged, the past criminal record or lack thereof of the defendants. I've also considered any lawful evidence which tends to show the motive of the defendants, their lack of remorse, their general moral character, and any predisposition to commit other crimes. Now, I think in this case, the record speaks for itself, and the defendant's own words, I think, guide this court with regard to sentencing. Went back through my notes and other resources to pull some of the quotes that we have in this case. I'll start with Greg McMichael. In my opinion, Greg McMichael, very early on in this, tried to establish a narrative. He made comments like, Ahmaud Arbery was trapped like a rat. Stop or I'll blow your, and I won't repeat it again, head off. He effectively admitted that he wasn't sure what Ahmaud Arbery had done wrong. Quote, I don't think the guy has actually stolen anything out there, or if he did, it was early in the process. But he keeps going back over and over again into this damn house. Again, back to the narrative. Told Travis, you have no choice. Told another individual at the side or at the scene, this guy ain't no shuffler. This guy's a... Commented that he wanted him, Ahmaud Arbery, to know that we weren't playing. If I could have gotten a shot at the guy, I would have shot him. Travis McMichael claims he was in shock. But it's interesting because he talks about his concern for his child and his own well-being. Part of this was while the victim was actually laying there in the street. Commented, this is the worst day of my life. Well, I think it's been touched on here today. There were other individuals that were impacted.
Part of the statement that Judge Timothy Walmsley gave before sentencing the defendants for the Ahmaud Arbery murder in the courtroom in Brunswick, Georgia. Again, both Travis and Gregory McMichael, the two of the defendants, got life in prison without the possibility of parole, and the third defendant, William Roddy Bryan, life with the possibility of parole. Legendary actor Sidney Poitier has died at the age of 94. Associated Press describes him as a groundbreaking actor, enduring inspiration who transformed how black people were portrayed on screen, and the first black actor to win an Academy Award for Best Lead Performance and the first to be a top box office draw. AP also adds this, his appeal brought him burdens not unlike other historical figures such as Jackie Robinson and the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. He was subjected to bigotry from whites and accusations of compromise from the black community. In 2009, then-President Barack Obama awarded Poitier the Presidential Medal of Freedom.
It's been said that Sidney Poitier does not make movies. He makes milestones. Milestones of artistic excellence. Milestones of America's progress. On screen and behind the camera, in films such as The Defiant Ones, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, Uptown Saturday Night, Lilies of the Field, for which he became the first African-American to win an Academy Award for Best Actor. Poitier not only entertained, but enlightened, shifting attitudes, broadening hearts, revealing the power of the silver screen to bring us closer together. The child of a Bahamian tomato farmers, Poitier once called his driving purpose to make himself a better person. He did, and he made us all a little bit better along the way.
Former President Barack Obama at the White House presenting Sidney Poitier and others with the Presidential Medal of Freedom back in 2009. That from C-SPAN's video library. Also from our library, here is Sidney Poitier giving college graduates some advice about life at Claremont McKenna College, the commencement in 2002.
The narrowest view life will ever offer of itself is reserved for those of us who never venture forth, who never travel those unknown roads. Life knows who we are. She also knows where we are. But she really comes looking for those of us who are at the heart of ourselves, spectators. Her engines are not fired by us. She instead waits anxiously for the coming of the curious traveler, to whom she offers no guarantee that one road will lead to another, no promise that we won't get lost, as surely we will from time to time, no promise that we won't find ourselves abandoned where disaster of some unimaginable kind waits, and there be left to stand our ground with only instinct for guidance and trial and error for judgment. Left to perish or prosper alone, deserted, life is tough, damn right. She knows curiosity sharpens instinct. Instinct invites trial and error. Trial and error produces experiences. And experiences are the only armor, the only protection she provides for those travelers who will spend their days on beckoning unknown roads that pull at their curiosity. If you feel you can summon the resolve necessary to stand firm in face of all life's challenges with no guarantees, that's a good sign.
Actor Sidney Poitier, part of his college commencement speech at Claremont McKenna College, California, in 2002. You can find the full speech at our video library at cspan.org. He's died at the age of 94. A number of tributes coming in, this from Congresswoman Joyce Beatty, Democrat from Ohio, chair of the Congressional Black Caucus. She tweets, "I'm saddened to hear of the passing of Sidney Poitier, a barrier breaker on screen and off. Rest in power." Thanks for listening to Washington Today. For more top Washington stories, subscribe to C-SPAN's evening newsletter word for word at c-span.org/connect. I hope you have a good night and weekend.